Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Today's episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark is brought to you by Parcast Presents Halloween, an incredible new paranormal podcast from the folks at Parcast, available now on Spotify, with 3 blood-curdling episodes each week in October, and by Native, the company dedicated to creating safe, simple, effective products that will leave you feeling your best and smelling great each and every day. I'll be back after our first story tonight to tell you a little more about Parcast Presents Halloween, and after the second, to provide more information about our friends at Native, including a special offer they have for those of you listening in tonight. Until then, go ahead and make sure your doors are locked, and check to make sure your closet doors are shut like they ought to be. That way, you'll have some warning when they creak open later while you're sound asleep. Stay tuned. The show's about to begin.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyrie, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome to Season 4, Episode 15. I'm your host, Otis Gyrie. In tonight's episode, I'll be performing 5 stories for you about terrible traditions, eerie eyes, off-limit addicts, malleable memories, and vicious visitors. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So, lock your doors, turn down your lights low, and settle in. The show's about to begin. Our first tale of terror this evening comes to us courtesy of author Maddie Kate. In it, we'll meet a town that takes children just a bit too seriously. Without further ado, I present to you In Our Town. In our town, you prayed for a boy when you first felt that kick in your belly. Mama said she cried the day I came out of her. She was so happy. I've been blessed as a son. Every birthday was a celebration for us, whole family coming around with sweet cakes and rye whiskey, friends and neighbors filling our back porch. My gramps would bring his guitar, only played on special days, since his hands were lost to arthritis. We'd stay up till the stars showed, everyone drinking, my uncles pouring out baby drinks for us young ones in tin cups, everyone laughing in the bonfire light. Coyotes howling in the blacktop mountains behind the fence that separated our backyard from the edge of the tree line. Birthdays were a cause for joy, a reminder that sometimes God listened to your prayers, didn't always make you suffer. Birthdays for my cousin were a different affair, Lila. She was 3 and some years older than me. She'd babysit when my parents would go out dating, as if those 3 years between us meant much more than the fact that she was a head taller and always beat me at hide-and-seek. She had long strawberry hair our grandma would brush out in front of the TV for. Lila loved watching quiz shows, so sharp she'd always know the answers before they came up on the screen. I half believed her when she'd wave her hands in the air in front of her face and tell me she wasn't smart, just psychic. Grandma would always shush her and say we shouldn't joke about such things, but she would wink at Lila and smile. When I was really small and couldn't sleep, she'd sing to me old songs about apple trees and drowned lovers, songs her mama sang to her. I could never remember the words. Some nights I'd lie awake in the dark and try singing to myself, but the sounds got stuck in my chest, buried too deep to dig out. Lila was also the only one my parents would let take me swimming in the creek round back of Gramps' farm, where nobody could bother us. My uncles offered time and time again, but Mama always refused, laughing and pouring another beer to pacify their pride, saying they were most likely to drown me than show me how to float. Lila was the one that taught me to swim, hands ever patient and holding my head above the water when I went under for too long. "Swim, Wren, you gotta swim," she would say as she pulled me to the surface. On her birthdays, the women would go over in the early morning, sitting round her and her mother, overlapping arms in their cotton print sundresses, offering what little comfort they could, sipping berry wine and praying occasionally, hands all tangled in the wooden rosaries they carved in the winter. Mama would be up the night before baking sweetbreads and whiskey doughs. My daddy always told me to stay out of the kitchen on baking days. Baking days were just for Mama, when she could get out all her grief and pour it into the food she made for her sister, each dish an apology, a comfort, an acknowledgment of loss. Us men and boys would go over in the evening, sitting silent and smoking around Lila's old man and her stepbrothers, tobacco passing between uncles and cousins, and all the things that went unsaid. On Lila's birthdays, everyone was drinking for a different reason. Bittersweet. In our town, birthdays were a reminder of another year gone, another year closer to the day they would die. In our town, you were only safe once you turned 18, down to the hour. In our town, once there was blood between your legs, you only had so many summers left. In the old days, my gramps told me it used to be once every 6 years. The town would go down to the lake on the last Saturday of summer, dressed in white or the closest you could get, everyone lining up along the banks to wash their hands clean in the water. And then a name would be drawn. Somebody's daughter, sister, lover, cousin. A girl next door, a girl you'd grown up with. Someone with dreams about seeing the world outside the state lines. Someone with favorite songs and best friends and promises to keep. The girl would walk into the lake and would be held by her mama for the last time. The woman she was grown from, dipping her low into the water so she shone in the sunlight, skin dripping. She'd smile for her daddy, despite the tears he'd catch with his hands, so he'd remember her well. Then she would start to swim, out into the middle of the water until she reached the other side, the one always lost in the mists, even in deep summer. Nobody had even seen the other side, even from the boats. It was something you stayed away from. Current always tugging you back, a warning. And she'd never be seen again. The thing was, it wasn't the old days anymore. Grandma told me things started going wrong in the gaps between those 6 years, just as my parents and uncles and aunts had graduated high school. Lambs being born with the skin around their eyes green, blind from the moment they came into the world. Dogs howling for days on end, until their lungs collapsed and they died from exhaustion. People waking up with dead moths covering the floors of their hallways, piled so deep you couldn't see the carpet beneath them. At first, people just came to accept that something in the trees was changing, and for whatever reason, was throwing things a little off balance. Then the rain stopped. People began to worry, but put it down to a dry spell and nothing more, despite the fact that the rain came every October without fail, and had done so since people first lived here back in the days of candlelight and wagons, before the trees were tamed. Then the cows started milking blood, and the dirt started turning black, swallowing anything planted. And then the babies started being born without their legs, or their arms, or their eyes. My Uncle Jonah was born legless, Mama's youngest brother. Gramps says it didn't matter because he could drink like a man standing up. I liked Jonah best. He was always loud, laughing, and cracking jokes that had everyone clutching their sides like their ribs were about to spill their organs on the floor. He had a voice like Johnny Cash, and you could tell Gramps was proud when he sang along with his guitar, because when Jonah sang, everyone forgets about his legs for a while. But he could be quiet, too, could convince birds down from the trees to eat out of his hand. Sometimes I'd catch him looking real sad, though, watching me and my cousins playing tag, or watching his brothers dance with their wives. So Grandma said that 6 years became 4 years, and it was okay the first time. But then the lake started to dry up. Things started washing up on the shore, baby bones and drowned rabbits with too many eyes. Deer started getting bloodthirsty, running out of the woods with their eyes white and teeth sharp, stealing chickens. People had stopped fishing out on the water because when they would drag up their nets, they'd be full of snakes. They would toss them back, but a few always made it to shore. One of them found their way into church and bit the preacher right on the wrist. The preacher bashed its head in with his Bible. Old folks started sleepwalking at night, lining up on the edge of the lake and waking in the morning, with no memory of walking there barefoot, feet all cut up and muddy. So 4 years became 2 years, and it was okay the first time, too. But people started getting scared to bring their babies into this world, and so parents stopped having kids. People started seeing things in the mist. Then the dreams started. My best friend, Tommy's dad, was one of those that had the dreams. I went with him to the cemetery a couple of times to visit when we were kids. Tommy always brought one of his Power Rangers or a race car to leave on top of the grave in case his daddy got bored in heaven, even though there wasn't actually a body in the ground. Tommy said he didn't know what the dreams were about and that his mama wouldn't tell him. Grandma wouldn't tell me either, but she said that the dreams made 30 people real sad and that they couldn't stop feeling sad. So they all swam into the lake one day, and they didn't stop until they reached the bottom. So 2 years became once a year, and the rains came back, and people started sleeping better, and people started fishing on the lake again, and the flowers grew a little brighter and the air a little warmer, and the high school football team suddenly won every game. The mini-mart that had been on the edge of closing down suddenly sold fruit so good people would drive in from towns over to buy it. Cherries like drips of blood, peaches soft enough to be skin, and everywhere over town the apple trees heaved with offerings. And yet, families lived in constant fear of having a daughter, like all of them were walking around with hunting knives twist deep in their spines that they just had to bear. Little girls grew up walking around with grief so heavy it would break their back if they had understood what was coming for them when they grew up. It was Lila's 15th birthday, and she was nowhere to be seen. Her mama, Clara, was crying on a lawn chair, sipping some lemonade she'd pressed with me, and Lila, the night before, hands sweet with sugar and rind. Clara was my mama's younger sister, but she looked years older, lines pressed into her face from years of holding all that sorrow just beneath the surface. When she laughed, though, you could see her true age, smile lines softening around her eyes as she grinned, hair coming loose from the tight braid she'd normally pull it back in. Lila loved to make her laugh, was often the only one that could. Mama and her sisters-in-law sat around her, long-legged and stretched out in the afternoon sun, a couple of my baby cousins tugging at the bottoms of their frayed jean shorts for attention or hanging off their hips. Daddy sat with my Uncle Red, Lila's father, hand resting on his plaid-clad shoulder. None of her friends had come to her birthday party, and she had run off heartbroken. The year before last summer, Sky, Lila's best friend since the first day of school, had her name pulled. None of her friends could face another birthday party that could be any of their last before they headed out across the water, so it had been a no-show. Candles and cake lay melting untouched, dripping off the pine table Red had made way back when, and there was more than just lemonade in Clara's glass. But I knew where to find her. I walked to our grandparents' farm in the low-slung sunlight, kicking up dust trails with the tops of my sneakers, scattering the June bugs still sucking on the flowers, even though June was long gone. The farm was pretty empty, except for the cows. I lowered my head as I passed them, white-bellied with their long eyelashes, keeping away the flies. I hated the way the cows watched you pass, eyes all-knowing as they stood so still, all of their heads turning to watch you go. Grandma said sometimes it was best not to look at the cows, just to let them get on with their business. She told me I had nothing to worry for as long as I didn't turn around once they were behind me. They didn't take kindly to that. As I walked, I could feel them watching me in the heat, grass a hush around my legs as I walked through the fields and past the barn with its peeling red paint. Lila was floating in the middle of the creek, hair around her head like strings of bloody flowers. She looked so peaceful with her belly up to the sun, eyes closed and trailing her hands through the lily weeds. I called her name, and she didn't move. Behind me, something rustled in the tall grass, maybe a snake or a rabbit. I called again, voice drunk up by the fields. She was dead, I knew. Kicking my shoes off and running out to her, ready to push the water from her lungs. Bring her back. I fell into the water, throwing my shirt behind me, yelling her name. She flipped over and turned to face me. "Ren, calm down. I was just daydreaming." She half smiled, pushing her hair from her face. I splashed her, sending an armful of creek over her head. "You scared me," she laughed, splashing me back, both of us fighting, until we could hardly breathe for laughing and the water in our mouths.
"Everyone's looking for you at the party,"
I told her. She shrugged and turned to float, belly up again, toes stretched out, to kick at the butterflies skimming the surface. I joined her, drifting. We spent the afternoon together, swimming and daydreaming, and trying to catch the tiny fish that lived in the mud with our hands. As the sun went down behind the barn and the creek turned cold and green, we lay out on the bank in our underwear, letting the sunset warm us dry. Lila turned to me. The lights in the farmhouse were on, porch lit, and beckoning us home. "You gotta promise me some things, all right? When I'm gone?" I cut her off. "Where are you going? Can I come?" She didn't reply, just carried on as if I'd said nothing. "When I'm gone, I need you to promise me you won't ever go swimming with anyone else. And if you try out for the football team, shower when you get home, okay? Don't ever drink or drive, or your daddy will kill you. Be nice to girls, but don't start dating until you're out of school. Don't let them get into your pants either. Trust me on that one. Us high school girls got nothing to lose. Kiss your mama goodnight. Listen hard to Grandma when she tells you stories, because most of them are truer than you could ever know. Make Jonah teach you how to get birds in your hand, because he never had the time to teach me, and now I'll never get to know." She smiled, but it wasn't in her eyes. Her voice wobbled a little towards the end. "And tell my mama about me every once in a while. You don't have to do much. Just sit there with her sometimes and talk. I don't want her to forget." She jumped to her feet then and ruffled the hair on top of my head, messing it up like she had done since we were little. She ran off into the purple dark, long-legged, with her hair out behind her. It was the last time I ever saw her. The day Lila was chosen, I was in church with all the other kids who weren't allowed down to the lake on the last Sunday of summer. Me and Tommy and his cousin Beth were seeing who could run the fastest, racing down the wedding aisle, sunlight streaming through the high glass windows in golden lines, zigzagging between us. Beth was sad that day because her best friend, Leanne, was allowed down to the lake for the first time, and she was real worried she wouldn't come back. So I'd let her play tag with us, even though Tommy said girls couldn't run for shit. I was going to go slower and let her outrun me so she'd feel better. Beth proved us both wrong, beating us every time. So fast, we didn't even have to let her win. Could barely keep up as she paced through the pews, hair flying behind her, as Jesus watched us from the cross above the door. When my dad came to pick me up, I asked him where Mom was, as she always came to get me on church days. Daddy said she was with Claire and Grandma, and when I asked why, he said he'd explain when he got home. We drove home in his pickup truck, and he let me choose the music the whole ride home. The house was empty when we arrived, followed by a low sinking feeling in my back teeth. I always got that before the storm, even when the sky was clear. Dad sat me down on the porch and opened two beers, pouring half of one out into the grass before handing it to me. I wondered absentmindedly if the beer would get the worms chewing on the soil drunk. I wondered if they'd be too drunk to get home. Dad explained that Lila had gone. I told him I knew, that she'd told me last week she was going away. Daddy started at that, shoulders jumping like a coyote backed in a corner. He smiled with tears in his eyes, sipping his beer. "I'm not surprised. That girl always knew what was going to happen. Had your grandma's witchy ways about her." He grinned, shaking his head and brushing a straight tear away with his thumb knuckle. Daddy opened his second beer as he explained that Lila's name got pulled, and she wasn't going somewhere you can come back from. Boys don't cry, even when it hurts. Daddy always taught me that. But he had cried too, so I thought maybe this time it was allowed as I put my head in my hands. Daddy put a hand on my shoulder and let me cry it out loud as the moon slid slowly out from behind the blacktops, until I felt the whole sky would fill up with all the grief stacked up on our shoulders. It was 2 summers after Lila had gone. I was 14, had started high school. Me and Tommy had decided to shave our heads and started lifting weights my uncles let us borrow, determined to be the hardest guys to walk the hallways when we got back. Beth had even done us matching tattoos on our backs of our shoulders with a biro and her mama's sewing needle. Matching crosses, bone, turned holy before we'd fully grown. Gramps let me borrow his truck sometimes, and me and Tommy would drive to the McDonald's in the next town over, because our town didn't have one. Sometimes we'd take the girls with us, impressed by four wheels and the promise of a milkshake, even though they intimidated us a little. Girls in our town were like wild animals. They could drink more than both of us combined, wore their skirts short enough that you didn't have to imagine that hard what was underneath. And when they kissed, they were all teeth and hands. Beth and Leanne grew up fast. Leanne had her tongue pierced and liked to take boys under the bleachers when she got bored. Tommy was one of those boys. Came back to see me with stories of belt loops and lip gloss stains. Beth said the girls in our town were ticking time bombs that had no idea when they were going to go off. Beth once kissed me in the back of my daddy's truck after I'd driven her home, in the winter when snow had turned the mountains into ghosts. She asked me to stay and have a smoke with her, said it made her feel lonely doing it by herself. She tasted red like the cherry wine her older sisters gave her, and she undid her winter coat and put my hand inside her shirt. I could feel her heartbeat through my palms. When her hand moved down to the zipper on my Levi's, I pushed her away gently, remembering Lila's warning. She cried then, and I held her. 14 and unsure what to do but kiss her forehead, do her coat back up. She told me if she was still here when we graduated, she was going to love me forever. It was the night before the last Sunday of summer. The sun had all but gone from the sky, leaving town in a hurry. I'd gone to bed early that night, a low sinking feeling in the back of my teeth, like the ones I'd get before watching a game our football team would eventually lose. Outside the windows I heard the coyotes started to sing, weaving their voices with the nightbirds high up in the trees. I could hear the TV on downstairs, drifting upstairs like muffled waves. I dreamt about Lila running through the purple sky, hair streaming out behind her. I'd had this dream many times before, and each time I ran after her, she'd be too fast, leaving me behind. But this time, she turned around and stretched her arms wide out toward me. Her voice was slow, like she was talking through a wall, lagging in time. "Swim, Ren. You have to swim," she said, eyes wide as she pointed behind me. I turned as a wall of lake water rushed at me, pulling me under into the deep. I woke up sweating, sheets a tangled mess beneath my back. The sky outside was turning blue, streaked up with gold like God spilled something across it. I could hear my heart banging so loud it sounded like it was coming from every direction. There was a wetness between my legs I could feel on the inside of my thighs. I yanked the sheets back, and my hand came back red and sticky with blood. I yelled for my mama, convinced I was dying, organs bleeding out through my stomach. My heartbeat was so loud, I held my head in my hands. Mama ran into my room. She saw the blood on my hands and collapsed on the ground, knees bending like she was about to pray. "Jesus, forgive us!" She started to cry. I saw Daddy grab his gun from under the bed and stand at the top of the stairs. "Please forgive us." "They're coming, Lorna. Not a thing we can do." He turned to look at me over his shoulder, and something like the seven stages of grief passed over his face faster than I could keep up with. "Ren, I'm so sorry. We thought we could save you." The banging was now so loud it was shaking the walls, and as the front door was kicked in, I realized it wasn't my heart at all, but the sounds of fists on the walls of our house. Gramps ran up the stairs, followed by Grandma, who was clawing at his arms, while trying to hold him back. He pushed her aside. He looked down the barrel of my daddy's gun, and Dad handed over silently, turning away with his eyes closed as Mom screamed at him. Mom jumped from the floor and stood in front of me like she was shielding me. "Step aside, Lorna." Mom shook her head. Gramps stepped towards her, pointing the gun. "Don't think I won't. It's the way things have always been, and the way things always must. Step aside." "Mama." I stood, hand on his shoulder, and gently pushed her aside to face my grandfather. This was the same man who taught me to drive. The man who gave me my first beer. The man who sat up with me all night during thunderstorms when I was little, sitting under the kitchen table with me as I cowered, and telling me it was just God moving his furniture and there was nothing to be afraid of. The same man who was now pointing a gun towards the center of my chest. He was crying, I realized, which scared me even more. I'd never even heard of my gramps crying. Not on his wedding day, not even when Lila went away. He gritted his teeth and held out a hand towards me. "You best come with me, Ren." So I did. We drove to the lake in silence. In the taillight glares, I could pick up Daddy's truck following behind. I studied my gramps, watched his hands on the wheel. The button on his shirt he'd missed, obviously dressing in a hurry. I had nothing left to say to him, so I didn't. When we got to the water, most of the town was already there, lined up alongside the lake. All the girls were dressed in white with flowers in their hair. Gramps opened the door. He hesitated and tugged the rosary down from where it hung on the rearview mirror and placed it around my neck. He walked me to the water and stared. Everyone stared, in eerie silence. It was as if the people in town moved as one. The closer I looked, all of their chests rising and falling at the same time, as they slowly raised their left hands to point at me from the crescent they made around the lakeside. Gramps turned to Mama, who had come up behind us, held up by Dad as she cried, grief trying to pull her bones to the ground. "Please, Lorna, please don't make this worse than it needs to be. Ren deserves that, at least." I saw Tommy and his mama in the crowd. Both were blank-faced and pointing, even when I caught Tommy's eye. His mama's wedding ring flashed on her finger, still there even after all these years. I felt a hand slowly slide into my own, knotting our fingers together. Me and my mother walked into the lake together. The water was cool around my waist as we stood facing each other, me in my ratty t-shirt and her in her sweatpants. She smiled, bottom lip held fast by her teeth to stop the shaking, as the tears kept coming. She held my face in her hands a moment, staring into the green of my eyes we both shared. Same as Grandma. Same as Lila. I had none of my daddy's brown-eyed ways about me,
just that strange light green. Mama cradled me a moment in the water and dipped me low. The lake rushed over my head, cool green and soothing, like fingers running through my hair. I thought I could hear singing, soft and half-drowned sounds about apple trees and murdered lovers. And suddenly, I understood everything about everyone in town. It was like the lights turning on after being born in the dark, terrifying and brilliant all at the same time. I knew why Tommy's daddy swam in the lake. I knew why Jonah drank at home alone on his twin-sized mattress. I knew why Beth's parents had divorced when she was small. I knew what the preacher really did on Sunday nights at the strip club in the next town over. I knew why the girl that sat behind me in math had hidden scars all the way up both of her legs, from ankle to hip bone. I knew that Lila had known she was going to die the last time I saw her. I knew every story, and addiction, and sin, from the people that had raised me, the people I'd grown up with, every dirty thing behind every closed door, every unsung act of kindness and salvation, beatings and bruises and love, so much love, all wrapped up in hundreds of heartbeats from my neighbors and friends and the strangers I'd pass on the streets of our town every day. My head broke the surface of water, and I knew what was really between my legs. That when my mama had felt that first kick in her stomach, like all the women in our family, she had known what would happen. Had felt that low pain in her back teeth, that I would be born a girl, green-eyed and raised to be swallowed by the lake. So her and my daddy had made the decision to raise me safely, to protect me from the thing that kept our town's blood flowing. I saw my whole life around me as I went under again. Every rule they'd made, every passing piece of advice that was carefully constructed to keep my reality intact. A secret my parents had carried around with them for 14 years. But you can't hide from nature. I felt it then, the thing under the lake, older than anything up on the land with our fragile bones and thin minds, our gods and our houses, somewhere deep within the water. I felt it calling me, tugging at my ribs and lungs. I started to wade out in the deeper water, lake slowly rising up the ribs my mother made me when I grew inside her. And as I left my mother behind, I forgave her. I forgave my daddy for not fighting what was inevitable. I forgave my uncles and aunties, the people my little cousins would grow up to be. I forgave my gramps for the rage and the grief that had got the better of him. I forgave my grandma for not telling me sooner. I forgave everyone in the whole damn town standing up on the lakeside watching me go. All the terrible and beautiful things they would do and had done throughout their long little lives. The lake reached up to my jaw and started filling my mouth, cool against my tongue. I felt the trees shift in the dirt, felt the chain-link fences in the backyard swaying, felt the bends in the road and the fruit as it grew. I felt everything, and I knew everything. I heard Layla's voice calling me from the other side, through the mist. I imagined her red hair floating on the lake's surface, like blood or strange flowers. Swim, Wren! You gotta swim! And so, I did. I hope you enjoyed In Our Town by author Maddie Kate, as performed by yours truly. Up next, we've got another terrifying tome, this one from a writer who prefers to be known simply as the Divine Author. Nice. About a man who sees
more when he closes his eyes than he does with them open. Unfortunately for him, the things he sees can see him too. Before I proceed, however, I'd like to tell you a bit more about tonight's first sponsor, Parcast, and their latest podcast program, Halloween. As All Hallows Eve gets closer, celebrate the spooky with Parcast Presents Halloween. This new podcast series on Spotify brings you three blood-curdling episodes each week in October. From urban legends to haunted places, Parcast Presents Halloween takes you on a historical tour of terror. Hear the stories of an escaped killer on the prowl, a gruesome discovery by four young friends, the legendary killings of Salem's first witches, and much more. Search for Parcast Presents Halloween in the Spotify app and start listening for free. If you enjoy what you hear, please help support the show's creators by leaving them a rating and a kind word in a review, and let them know that Otis Gyrie and Scary Stories Told in the Dark sent you. It would mean a lot to me. Thanks for giving Parcast Presents Halloween a listen this spooky season. Now that we've helped provide you with a Halloween history lesson, courtesy of our friends at Parcast and Spotify, allow me to give you a second helping of frightening fiction with another spooky tale of my own. Get your safety blanket and hold on tight. Our second story tonight is a real eye-opener. Without further ado, from the divine author, I present to you The Eyelid Man. The tale of the Eyelid Man is still strong. Based on the unfortunately minimal amount of information I can find on what I saw, my experiences with it have been one of a kind. I'm almost certain that the majority of you are in no harm whatsoever from him. I'm not writing this to tell you how you or your loved ones may be in danger, but rather to officially document my story. Should you encounter the thing, very little can be done to save you from my fate. You may stop reading this anytime you like, but the only thing you need to know is this. The Eyelid Man is real. I know he is. He's with me right now. It was several months back when I first started seeing the thing. At first, it was nothing I could pinpoint. I began having the unmistakable feeling that I was being watched just about everywhere I went. This wouldn't have been so much of an issue if the feeling had eventually subsided. It never did. No matter where I was or what I was doing, even if I was sure that I was alone, I felt the pressure of eyes staring at me. I could never see who it was or gauge where it was coming from, but I knew that feeling. Privacy was quickly becoming a luxury I was no longer able to afford. The stress began to settle in soon after. I started losing a little more sleep each night. The feelings progressed. I began noticing random flashes of a single image in my mind. These images all happened at odd, inconsistent intervals throughout my day. Every now and then, out of the corner of my eye, or occasionally after blinking, my brain registered a single image for a split second, though nothing was ever there. The weird thing about it was that it was always the same image. Two wide, unyielding eyes staring at me. Now, the feeling of being watched was consistently an issue, so I wanted to blame the image on the stress or lack of sleep, but the surprise of seeing those eyes staring back at me was not something I could brush off so easily. They were wide, very wide. They appeared to be slightly bloodshot and very, very still. The pupils were extremely dilated, and they were always directly centered on mine. There were no other facial features in the image, just eyes. The most unsettling thing about them was that they were perfectly circular. They almost didn't look human. They appeared human, but no one's eyes are that geometrically flawless. After several days of seeing this single image occur in my mind more and more often, that is when I could ignore it no more. I began scheduling appointments with all sorts of doctors and specialists. I even tried therapy for the first time. Nothing worked. My fear of the image quickly turned into annoyance and frustration. My girlfriend, Alice, with whom I had been living with at the time, was very supportive and did her best to be there for me every time I had an episode. But what she did was of little help as well. After I had wasted much of my time and most of my money with doctors, I began to see the image less frequently. It became easier to brush off the whole ordeal as a weird, reoccurring hallucination. For a while, I was able to enjoy entire nights of sleep again. After I began no longer seeing the eyes in my mind, I started seeing them elsewhere. I would still have the constant feeling of being watched, but occasionally I would look a certain direction in a crowded area and see a person staring at me. Whether it was at the grocery store, the park, or even in busy restaurants, I'd catch someone staring back at me for inappropriately long periods of time. They'd even be on the other end of a large room from me. Although their being so far away didn't make me feel any better about the situation. What was especially unsettling was that it wasn't ever the same person. It was always a different person each time. The first time it was a woman at Walmart. She stood, among others, walking around like nothing was wrong. She just stood there staring back at me. The next time, it was a teenage boy at the mall. He was with a group of other boys, but none of them seemed to notice the odd behavior. The next was an old man staring outside his window into my house one night. He didn't move for hours, even after I'd left and come back to check to see if he was still there, standing and staring out of his bedroom window. I wanted to go over to these people and ask them what their problem was, but I couldn't. You see, the one thing they all had in common was their eyes. Each and every one of them had the exact same eyes that I had just gotten over seeing in my mind. Bloodshot, glaring, void of emotion, very wide and perfectly round. All the fears and anxiety came rushing back for every single time I saw them on someone's face. I quit my job. I wasn't able to focus on anything except keeping people away. I saw so scared that soon after, I stopped leaving the house altogether. My girlfriend was able to take care of us both for a while. I felt bad about putting so much pressure on her, but I didn't know what else to do. I just needed time to get away from people. I thought it would work, but like everything else I tried, it didn't. I occasionally looked out of my window to see the same stare plastered on some passing neighbor just outside my house. They just stood there for hours staring into my house. Most of their faces were usually expressionless. However, occasionally one would wear a devious grin that stretched across their entire face. I admit to being one who scares easily, but every one of those staring people terrified me more than anything I've ever known. I wanted to look away and shut the whole thing out as my own imagination. But after 3 weeks of seeing these sick, malice eyes, I knew I needed to face it. I needed to know what it wanted, but I was always afraid of approaching it. Seeing those eyes went from being a once-a-day occurrence to being once every single time I looked out of my window. Started with the old man across the street staring out of his window. It then took shape of drivers stopping just outside of my house to stare at me from inside their own cars. Within a week,
It turned into neighbors standing on the sidewalk outside of my house. It wasn't long after that that they started standing on my lawn. I tried to get my girlfriend to see them with me, but like every other person, she never saw anyone there. I would scream at them. I threatened the police on them. When I finally called the cops, they saw nothing too. I didn't want myself committed, so I tried to convince myself that they were just illusions for the sake of appearances, but I knew better than that. I chose not to look out the window for a while. I figured if I start giving them attention, maybe they'll go away. It had been 5 weeks, and I could tell my girlfriend was growing more and more upset that I was not feeling better. We barely spoke anymore. We shared a bed, but I never slept. She was so stressed out about having to work more to take care of me that I could tell she was on the edge of packing everything up and leaving. I couldn't blame her, but the last thing I wanted was to be alone. After a week of avoiding windows, I took a peek out of one and found no one there, no one around. I checked all around the window, expecting someone to be very close by, but there was no one in sight. I looked through all the other windows in the house. Not one of them showed someone staring at me. I even took a couple of steps outside my front door and still saw no one there. I laughed. I laughed completely without irony for the first time in weeks. It was all over. I could continue my life. I don't know what I was thinking. Whatever insurance was going through my mind at the time completely overshadowed the truth. I had not seen those eyes on anyone for several days. I was quick to go back out, look for a job, visit friends and family, and try to do what I could for Alice to thank her for all of her help, despite how cumbersome our relationship had grown. Everything was going so well. On this one night, I had just come home late from my parents' house for dinner and coffee. My girlfriend was already asleep, so I prepared myself for bed and curled up next to her. I turned on the television for light and some light sound before shutting my eyes. I felt her arm reach over in her sleep and lay on my shoulder. I felt her turn her body toward me. I loved her so much. I was so looking forward to repairing and rebuilding our relationship. I smiled and thought, she may have been awake. I looked at her and threw myself out of the bed and onto the floor. She was staring at me with those same wide, reddened, circular eyes. She smiled, not her normal smile, but an open, toothy smile, one that would be unnatural for anyone. I got up off the floor and wanted to run, but I couldn't look away. Those eyes followed me around the room. As I reached for the door, she sat up like a machine. I screamed. I threw the door open and ran for my keys, sprinted to my car, and I drove as quickly as I could. I had no destination, nor did I care that I left all my stuff behind. I didn't know where I was going or what I was going to do, but I knew that I'd never go back there. Those eyes. Those damn eyes. They found a way into my home and onto the woman I loved. I convinced myself that I would never go back, that I would be able to look at that face another second of my life. That image still remains burned into my memory like a warped, rotting tattoo. I drove until I could no longer stay awake. I pulled over at an overnight rest stop and slept in my car through the night. For about 5 days, I lived off the services of some nearby rest stop off the interstate. Afterward, I mustered up the courage and I went back. I couldn't hide from my life anymore. I had to face the reality of the situation head on, and my girlfriend needed a reason for why I left. Looking back at her face again was one of the hardest things I had ever done. As hard as it was for me, was how relieving it was to see that her face had returned to normal. I gave her the biggest hug and the most sincere apology I've ever given anyone before.
I was so glad I came back. I didn't want to leave her behind for good. I explained what I saw to her. I knew she wouldn't understand, nor did I expect her to, but she comforted me anyway. I just needed her by my side through it all. She agreed and made me promise that I would never do anything as crazy and irrational because of it. I promised half-heartedly. I didn't sleep in the same bed as her for many nights after I returned. I stayed in the guest room for those nights and made very certain that I locked the doors and the windows before going to bed. Everything was improving, but I knew better than to let that fool me again. In the coming days, I would force myself outside to crowded places and to interact with other people. I was very skeptical on how normal everything had become again. In fact, seeing those eyes on my girlfriend was the very last time I had seen those eyes on anyone. Soon enough, though, I began seeing them again. Not on everyone else, mind you, but on me, inside me. I would see them every single time I closed my eyes. Those eyes stared back at me from inside my own eyelids now. The eyes were so red with blood pumping veins, those piercing pupils digging into my mind. They were so perfectly round, as if the organs themselves had been ripped out of someone's head. I saw them constantly now, every time I closed my eyes. Anytime I blinked, they were there. Anytime I tried to sleep, they were there. Any time my eyelids could no longer fight against their own will to rest, they were there. You know that your eyes never turn off? They just get covered by the darkness of your eyelids. The eyes I was seeing penetrated that darkness. I would fall asleep with those eyes staring back at me. For the longest time, those eyes got closer and closer to me until they finally caught me. They burrowed into my body and invaded the one place I knew I could always be safe. I'd go days without sleeping, to the point where I would physically beat myself into unconsciousness just to get some rest without having to look at those eyes. I always did, though. I was always looking at them. They followed my own eyes from behind my closed eyelids. Even as I slept, they invaded my mind. They turned my dreams into nightmares and my nightmares into reality. I knew that I could no longer live this way. One night, as my girlfriend worked late, I scrawled down a short apology on a piece of paper and locked myself in the bathroom with a straight razor. I stood over the sink and held that razor against my wrist for what seemed like hours without emotion. I began to sob as I came to the realization I couldn't bring myself to end my life. I'd always been a coward, and I knew it. I hated crying that much more, because it forced me to close my eyes. I was sick of them. The fear I had for them was vastly outweighed by the hatred I had for those eyes following me around for so long and ruining my life. They invaded my body. They infiltrated my mind. They live, pulsating and searing their malicious stare behind my eyelids. That's when the idea happened. I raised the razor to my face. I clenched my teeth as the blade glided slowly and carefully through the top of my left eyelid. I had to give them no place to live. I could no longer stand their burning, hellish stare. I was determined to get rid of them one way or another. I had to constantly wipe blood away from the spot, along with keeping my hands smooth and steady. I removed my top left eyelid and dropped it into a puddle of blood accumulating in the sink. I began immediately on the bottom left, removing it from my face in the same slow, methodical fashion. Then came the next eye. I was much quicker with removing the infected skin on the other side with a little practice. I felt the blade cut slightly into my eyeball, but I cared very little at that point. I was able to cut away most of the top right eyelid, but ended up just yanking the rest off to save time. finally came off the bottom right eyelid, who soon joined the rest of the blood and tissue collected in the sink. It hurt so much, but the payoff was more than worth it. I would never have to look at those eyes ever again and could finally move on with my life. I washed away the blood from my face and the sink, as well as throughout the cursed eyelids. After I finished drying my face, I looked up in the mirror and I couldn't believe what I saw. Those eyes. Those same eyes. My new eyes were intensely bloodshot. The pupils were so wide they nearly swallowed all the white in an inescapable darkness. Their shape was so perfectly round, symmetrically circular in every way. I stared at myself in the mirror because that was all that I could do. I could only stare back at the same creature I had been hiding from for all this time. The eyes had finally caught up with me. Everyone now calls me the Eyelid Man. I hope you enjoyed The Eyelid Man by the divine author, as performed by yours truly. Up next, we've got another terrifying tome, this one from author Rally Zero, about a pair of siblings who just can't wait to see what's in the attic their grandmother always told them to stay out of. Before I proceed, however, I'd like to tell you a bit more about tonight's second sponsor, Native, and a special offer they have for those of you listening in tonight. The folks at Native are dedicated to creating safe, simple, effective products that people use in their bathroom every day with trusted ingredients and trusted performance. With 8,000 five-star reviews from customers and counting, Native makes it clear that all deodorants are not created equal. And they mean business when they say to you that you ought to take care of your body. It's the only place you have to live. Now I know what you're thinking. What makes Native so special? Well, first, and most importantly, Native's deodorants are formulated without aluminum, parabens, and talc. Tasty fillers, chemicals, and compounds that have no business being in or on your body at any time, let alone daily. Native's products are filled with ingredients you know and that are found in nature, such as coconut oil, shea butter, which helps moisturize, and tapioca starch, which absorbs wetness. Did you think deodorants needed all those chemicals and fillers to work? Think again. Native does the same work without the unnatural. Making the switch to an aluminum-free deodorant doesn't have to mean sacrificing product performance. We here at Scary Stories Told in the Dark had a chance to try out Native for the first time this past week, and simply put, it works. Not only did the coconut and vanilla scent remind me of pleasant memories of baking cookies in winter and warm summer days all at once, it does what it's supposed to. Keeps me dry and feeling comfortable all day long, whether I'm in the studio or out and about running errands. I've tried other aluminum-free deodorants, and I'll be honest, I nearly got turned out from the stuff because they just didn't seem to work as well as the stuff I grew up with. Some kept me smelling fresh, but they seemed like they make me sweat more than before. Others were irritating, and worse still, some didn't work at all, and actually made me smell worse. It was almost enough to give up on using natural deodorants entirely, but I'm glad I didn't. Native's deodorant works, and not only keeps me dry, but the scents are fantastic. All of them, and they don't quit until you do. Not only that, but Native never tests their products on animals, and they offer free shipping, returns, and exchanges in the USA, so there's no risk to try, even if you're unconvinced. With Native, less is more. With fewer, simpler ingredients, you can rest easy knowing everything that's in their deodorant. And without added aluminum, you know that no matter what scent you choose, it's going to be safe and effective. Speaking of scents, Native comes in a wide variety of enticing aromas that will appeal to both men and women, as lavender and rose, cucumber and mint, and eucalyptus and mint, or my personal favorite, and their most popular, coconut and vanilla. And if that's not enough, they release new limited edition seasonal scents throughout the year. And if you're sensitive to particular scents, no worries. Native offers unscented formula and baking soda-free formulas for you and your loved ones. They really have something for everyone. Still on the fence? I don't blame you. I've been burned by a lot of bad products in my day, and I like to see what other people think before I switch brands. Well, with Native, you can do just that, and there's no shortage of good reviews. People love Native. Don't believe me? Check out their 8,000-plus five-star reviews online, or check them out in the media, on the Today Show, Elle Magazine, Pop Sugar, and Refinery 29, to name a few. So what do you got to lose? We might specialize in losing you sleep here on this show, but you might as well smell and look awesome when you drag yourself out of bed the next day for work. With free shipping and no hassle returns if you're unsatisfied for any reason, there's never been a better time to try something new. And today, Native is making it even easier to switch. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com. Use promo code TOLD during checkout. Once again, for 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code TOLD. That's TOLD, T-O-L-D, during checkout. Be sure to use that code to let the kind folks at Native know that Otis Gyre sent you. It would mean a lot to me. Thanks so much for your time and for giving Native a try this month. Now that we've helped you look and smell your best, courtesy of our friends at Native, allow me to give you a case of the cold sweats that's perfect to test out your brand new deodorant with another terrifying tale. This one comes to us from author Riley Zero and offers a word of caution to those who would go around sticking their noses where they don't belong. Stay out. Without further ado, I present to you Little Lucy. Grandma Eloise had strictly forbidden everyone in the family from going into the attic of her old farmhouse. She insisted that the ceiling door was far too heavy, and that someone would throw out their back, get a splinter, or smash their fingers if they tried to lift it. So she was adamant about it that her children and grandchildren never went further than the first or second step before she appeared around the doorway, wooden spoon in hand. Emily and Garrett Newsom learned to fear their grandma's wooden spoon shortly after their fifth birthday. The twins had been playing tag when Emily had ventured up the steps to escape her brother's reach. "Emily," he had whined, "that's not fair. We're not allowed to go up there." Emily blew a raspberry in his direction and proceeded to climb up the stairs. She wasn't afraid of this door. She was five now, and she was going to prove that she was just as brave as any grown-up. As she made her way closer to the door, her brother's whining increased to teary-eyed, blubbery threats to tell Grandma. She ignored him. When she reached her hand up to feel the surface of the door, she was shocked to realize that it was cold, much colder than it had been outside on that mild Halloween day. Before she could think about it further, she went down crying from the sting of a wooden spoon smacking her backside. Grandma had been furious and lectured the twins for 30 minutes about how that part of the house was dangerous and off-limits before putting them both in time out. It was one of the twins' first memories of their grandmother, and the only time they ever saw her truly angry. 19 years later, to the day, and the twins found themselves staring up at the mysterious door. It had once been a pristine white but time and neglect had aged it into a peeling gray. The cobwebs of long-legged attic spiders had been woven over much of it, making it sticky to the touch. The twins shuddered. Neither one of them was a fan of spiders, but Garrett decided to put on a brave face and place both hands on the door. He cringed inside at the feel of the thin spider silk clinging to his flesh. Under the webbing, the door was surprisingly cold and smooth, despite the peeling paint. He braced himself to push up against gravity and the weight of the door and found it barely weighed more than 20 pounds. Grandma had been full of it when she said it was heavy. That, or maybe that gym membership was finally paying off. With ease, he lifted the door and let it fall to the other side of its hinges. The door landed with a bang, and a plume of dust rose into the air. Garrett poked his head into the dusty cavity and breathed in frigid air. "I don't know about this," he moaned to his sister. He'd never been a fan of anything Halloween, horror, or macabre, and going through his dead grandma's forbidden attic looking for old pictures for her funeral on Halloween night seemed to right up his nope alley. "What's the matter?" she sneered. "Afraid Grandma's ghost is still guarding the attic with that stupid wooden spoon?" She nudged her brother, urging him to get out of her way. She had never been afraid of the creepy and otherworldly. She had even joined a seance or two in college in hopes of having some sort of otherworldly experience. Nothing ever came from them, other than a girl getting so scared she peed herself at one, and Emily hooking up with some frat boy at the other. Since then, Emily had decided that ghosts were nothing but a hoax, and the scariest thing you could get from trying to summon them was freshmen freaking out over a draft. When Garrett didn't budge, she glared at him. "You're afraid of make-believe ghosts and ghouls, aren't you?" "No, it's not that," he lied. "It's just the attic feels freakishly cold. I'm worried there's a hole around letting cold air in, you know? And you know what else comes through holes in houses? Raccoons. Damn raccoons. You know how much I hate those damn trash pandas ever since the dumpster fire incident. The one where Frank Messino ended up having to get his eye removed because a flaming raccoon ran out and scratched the shit out of his face. They could be nested right under your nose and you don't see them until they're right there, biting your face off." His sister rolled her eyes and cocked a hip. She remembered how the dumpster fire incident had messed with her brother, but she knew a lie when she heard it. "Fine," she huffed. "How about you go look through Grandma's library, and I'll fight the raccoons for whatever Grandma hid up here. Sound good?" The waves of cold chills running down Garrett's spine almost had him racing to do just as his sister suggested. If she wanted to provoke whatever was up there, she could be his guest. He didn't want anything to do with that. Not one thing. "And yet, it's fine," he said, holding a surprisingly steady voice. His pride wouldn't let him back down. He made his way up the last of the steps before helping his sister into the frigid, dark space. Emily cracked a joke about how Grandma Eloise was probably doing barrel rolls at the funeral home right now that they were in the attic. Garrett managed a small scoff. The idea was kind of funny. The attic space was old and dusty, but had a surprisingly sturdy floor. Cobwebs draped the A-frame rafters, making the place feel like a Halloween display. Fitting for the time of year. The single, octagonal window had been boarded up to keep out bats, and only wisps of light from the moon trickled through. Emily flicked on her phone light, and they began their search. Garrett came across an old oak desk, draped with a crocheted doily. The hinges creaked as he opened the lid. Inside, he found some of Grandma's old cookbooks, a ton of Christmas cards, and a bunch of newspaper clippings with various family members being recognized over the years. Digging further down, he found several faded vintage photos. In one, he recognized the man and woman as younger versions of their grandparents. They looked happier than in other photos he'd seen. Sitting on their laps, he saw two little curly-haired girls. He figured one was Grandma Eloise, but he didn't know who the other one was. She looked like her twin, but Grandma Eloise had never mentioned having a sister, so maybe it was a cousin. Their family had been notorious for strong family resemblances. She decided that it would work for the funeral. Picking it up, he found another family photo of the four taken a few years later. Great-grandpa William had grown his signature handlebar mustache, and the girls looked older. Everyone had a solemn expression on their face. Garrett gasped. "What's the matter? You find your trash, Panda?" Emily snickered. "No, not quite." Garrett's head was reeling. I think I found a morning portrait." "So, like, taken at sunrise?" Garrett gave her a frown. "No, a morning portrait. Like, morning? You know, what we'll be doing tomorrow at Grandma's showing." "Oh, that morning. Gotcha." She sat down the dolphin snow globe that she'd been examining. "What's a morning portrait?" "It's an old-timey tradition where families would pose with the corpse of their loved one for one last photograph." Emily came over to examine the picture. "Whoa, who's the second girl?" "I'm not sure. I thought it may have been a cousin, but now I'm thinking Grandma had a twin sister who died young. Look at this photo. See how the girl's clear, but everyone else is blurry?" "Yeah. Back then, everyone came out blurry because in the time it took for the photo to process, people moved, they breathed, they blinked. Only a corpse comes out clear." Emily squinted at the image. "Then why is that doll blurry?" She pointed to the dead twin. In the corpse's hand sat a fuzzy image of a doll with black hair and light eyes that looked directly at the camera like it was trying to warn them. Garrett quickly stuffed the picture under the earlier one and shrugged. "No clue. Maybe the doll started slipping since it wasn't really being held." Emily nodded and went back to looking through the knickknacks. A few minutes later, Garrett jumped, smacked his head off one of the ceiling beams, and cursed when a music box began playing. "Damn it, Emily! Give me a warning before you decide to start playing freaking creepy music from one of those trinkets." Emily stared at him wide-eyed. "You mean it wasn't you?" She moved her phone around to find a small music box with a tiny ballerina turning on her post. The ballerina's face appeared to have been filed off. Round and round, the faceless dancer spun until her outstretched arm pointed in the direction of a chair covered in a yellow lace wedding dress. Emily took it off to look at. Garrett gaped and saw the doll from the photo sitting on the chair. She was bound with a rope around her body and a gag in her mouth. She was no bigger than a baby. Her face was an incredibly pale shade of porcelain, with dark circles under her eyes. Those creepy light eyes from the photo turned out to be a glassy blue that felt like they were piercing Garrett's soul. Her hair was disheveled, and the red paint from her lips had rubbed off onto the gag. Emily unbound the doll and straightened out her ruffled dress. She found a bracelet around her neck inscribed with a name. "Lucy," she read. "Do you think this was Grandma's sister's name?" Garrett didn't answer his sister. He was too busy staring at the doll. He could have sworn her face had changed in the time it took him to blink. The paint was no longer smudged around her mouth, and her painted eyebrows were drawn in a look of concern. In the next blink of his eyelids, the doll's glass eyes changed from staring at him to staring at the far wall of the attic. Just then, a sound like dog nails clicking on floor tiles started coming from the edges of the attic. "What's that?" his sister squeaked, clutching the doll closer. Garrett's mouth was dry. Dread welled up in his gut as the air in the attic dropped low enough that he could see his breath. No,
Wait. He was holding his breath, wasn't he? The floor door slammed shut. Garrett looked back at the doll to see her staring at him again. Bloody tears streamed down her face, and she wore a look of horror and apology a second before Emily's phone died. The clicking of the nail stopped as the twins grabbed a hold of each other.
"Garrett," his sister squeaked, "please tell me this is some sort of joke. Some sort of prank to get me to think ghosts are real."
He clutched his sister tighter, the doll forgotten between them. "Only if you tell me first." Demonic laughing, like nails on slate, filled the air from all around. The twins tried to cover their ears, but it did no good. Shadows, darker than the blackest night, rose from the edges of the room. First amorphous, then taking on twisted shapes. The music box started playing in loud, echoing notes as the shadowy creatures began to sing. "Poor little Lucy, bound and gagged in fear, now she's free to be our cheer. Dear little Lucy with the purest heart, she can't save a snitch and a tart. Dumb little Lucy thinks she'll bloody cry, all because her friends are gonna die." With the last line of a cacophony, the twins could hear a small voice between them crying out,
"No, please, I can't take this anymore. Why? They don't deserve this."
The demons laughed their screeching chortle once more before going silent. Garrett and Emily stood petrified, like rabbits surrounded by starving wolves. Without warning, the demons howled, and the twins felt the pain of their souls being shredded and torn from their bodies. Claws and fingers sliced and ripped into every fiber of their beings, cutting the sinews of spirit that held their souls to their physical forms. The pain was like nothing the twins had ever experienced before. They screamed and writhed, desperately trying to free themselves of the demons' grips, but it couldn't be helped. Lucy slid to the ground and watched through blood-stained eyes as her best friend's family members died the same horrible death she had. To a normal onlooker, they would just see two people standing motionless with wide-eyed expressions on their faces until their bodies collapsed. But Lucy could sense it all. Every piece of their souls being ripped and gnawed on. Every twist of pain as another sinew was cut. Every scream of the souls of the twins. Images of when Lydia had succumbed to the demons came flooding back to Lucy's mind. How they had almost snatched Eloise, too. It was too much, but all Lucy could do was sit there and cry her bloody tears as the demons screamed in delight. Their teeth glistened and dripped with black saliva as they devoured the last of Emily and Garrett, each demon taking turns taunting their favorite dolly. "Poor little Lucy, always there to see how cruel we demons are to sinners such as thee. Stupid little Lucy, when whilst thou see that this is the fate of all sinners? Defeated little Lucy, might we lap up some of your tears?" The demons continued to laugh and jeer late into the night before leaving little Lucy to grieve surrounded by the corpses of Emily and Garrett Newsom. 2 days later, the cops dragged the bodies of the twins from their late grandmother's attic. Nothing seemed amiss. It was like they had just dropped dead. This would make all the headlines for at least the next month. Not much happened in the town of Raleighsburg, and a double homicide on Halloween was the biggest news since the dumpster fire several years back. Officers Elroy and Mack had been first on the scene for that incident, and were now finding themselves on the scene of this one. They checked the house one last time that night before heading out. It was getting late, and Officer Mack's wife would be mad if he missed dinner because of work again. She had been hormonal with the pregnancy, and he didn't want to rock the boat tonight.
Officer Elroy was just as willing to head out as he was. Something about the old house set her nerves on edge. Walking through the kitchen, they heard a music box begin playing in the living room. Officer Elroy drew her gun with Officer Mack behind her. There hadn't been any of the forensics team left in the house. They were sure of that. Perhaps some punk with a camera came in to try to get a shot of the crime scene and bumped a music box. They rounded the corner and crept into the living room. On the coffee table sat a music box with a small ballerina with a filed-off face. She stopped with her stretched-out arm, pointing to a doll sitting in the mantel. She hadn't been there earlier, right? Officer Elroy looked at her and then gasped. Her eyes dripped tears of blood as the room became impossibly cold and the singing began. Poor little Lucy, sitting on a shelf, eyes streaming red as she's crying to herself. My little Lucy, this won't take long. Soon all you'll have will be our little song. Sweet little Lucy wouldn't hurt a fly. She can't help you. Now you're going to die. I hope you enjoyed Little Lucy by author Rally Zero, as performed by yours truly. I'd like to personally thank you for joining me for tonight's episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase a season's pass for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you will get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Finally, thanks again to today's sponsors, Parcast Presents Halloween and Native, for their support of this show. Don't forget, for 20% off your first purchase with Native, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code TOLD during checkout. Once again, for 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code TOLD. That's TOLD, T-O-L-D, during checkout. Be sure to use that code to let the kind folks at Native know that Otis Gyre sent you. It'd mean a lot to me. Thanks again for your time and for giving Native a try this month. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett.
Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groeschel. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.